The name
Rafael Nadal.
He's a tennis player, one of the best to ever do it. The interviewer was asking him pre-match, "How you feeling, Rafa?" And Rafa, paraphrasing, says, "I've been antsy, nauseous, had to go to the bathroom a few times. My mind's going 100 miles per hour. Feeling good. That's how I know that I'm ready." It was facilitative.
I get the most nervous going out for a game when we're sitting and waiting in the tunnel. Anxiety is because we're anticipating a future performance. The time goes by so slow because I just want to get on the field, because I know as soon as that whistle blows, all of that anxiousness goes away because I can run, work hard, and just like play, which is like my favorite thing to do.
We have reinterpretation, deliberate breathing, and more specifically, sigh breathing, normalization of the nerves and anxiety, preparation. And then you just mentioned another one.
Welcome to Ditto, episode number
Dos. 2.
Super excited to talk about what we're going to talk about today. We are going to talk about nerves and performance anxiety, something that I feel like all of us have experienced at one point or another, or probably some of us more than others. Me especially as a professional athlete, but people who work in a business, or if you have a job interview, or if you're a student, I feel like this discussion can apply to lots of different people in different fields. So I'm really excited to talk about it, especially with you, Matt, because I feel like you have a lot of experience working with people in all walks of life with performance anxiety and nerves and how to handle them, because they are a normal part of life. I feel like we don't talk about that enough. Mm-hmm. And talk about how it's perfectly normal to be nervous for things. But yeah, I think I'm going to pass it on to you to kind of get us started, and maybe you can just share with us what you've seen in your field with helping people or athletes, etc., deal with nerves or performance anxiety.
Yeah, super interesting, important topic. The normalization of anxiety, like you said, first and foremost, I think is so paramount in ultimately developing a different/healthier relationship with anxiety, because we're never going to get rid of it as hard as we want to, or as bad as we want to, but we can develop a different relationship, a different perspective with it. And that in turn is going to facilitate our performance. Yeah, like you said, Ashley, I mean, we've worked on this extensively together. We've talked about this extensively together. You've experienced this, obviously, at a really high level in sport. But I've talked to a number, like you said, a number of individuals where this is everywhere. I mean, whenever you're having to perform, and more often this is, if you think about it, in front of other people, right? We don't experience much anxiety, especially kind of quote unquote pre-performance anxiety, if there aren't other people involved. And so, you know, having to speak in front of people, you're giving a talk or a speech in front of people, having to perform a musical number on stage, having to give a presentation in business, having to take a test in a class as a student. I mean, these are all experiences that I think we all can relate to on some level. And then in your case, like having to kick a penalty kick in front of thousands of people, right? And yeah, move on in a tournament or whatever it might be. So anyways, you know, broadly defined, again, I think it's helpful to define some of these things that we talk about. There are quite a few, as usual, definitions as it pertains to anxiety. Basically how I define it, or how I unpack it, is worry and or fear about future events. I mean, if you think about it, that's what it is. And when you think about it in that way, this is where mindfulness for me, and I know you can attest to this, is so helpful. Because when we're present, if you think about it, anxiety doesn't exist, because we're not thinking about the future. The here and the now, anxiety can't exist. And so, you know, us contemplating, ruminating, and staying in the future can result in unwanted anxiety. However, anxiety isn't always a bad thing. It can push us and drive us and motivate us, right? And so here's an example that I know we've talked about before, especially you and I, but I know we've shared this on social media before, but I think it's worth repeating, because it illustrates just perfectly this idea of reinterpreting and reexamining our relationship with anxiety. So the name Rafael Nadal from España.
That was a really good tongue roll.
I know, right? I got my Spanish dude. He's a tennis player, obviously. One of the best to ever do it. I don't care if you're a Roger Federer fan or a Djokovic fan or whomever. Nadal's one of the best. And he was playing in a match, and it was a major, and I believe it was the U.S. Open. Do not quote me on that. It might have been the French Open or somewhere else. And he's being interviewed. And the interviewer was asking him, you know, pre-match, you know, how you feeling, Rafa? Ready for the match? Blah, blah, blah. I can't remember the exact wording. And Rafa, paraphrasing, says, yeah, I'm feeling ready. I've been antsy. I've been nauseous. Had to go to the bathroom a few times. You know, my mind's going 100 miles per hour. Feeling good. And of course, the interviewer's...
perfectly normal.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, the interviewer's like, okay, is this going to be detrimental to your performance? You know, to the match that you're about to play to win in the final of the U.S. Open? And he goes, oh, no. It's how I know that I'm ready. And so again, his interpretation of at least the physiological response to anxiety, the butterflies, the sweating, the having to go to the bathroom, the you can't hold still, rumination, thoughts going like this. It was facilitative. Like, how powerful is that? And you can train to do that. It's consistent. It's deliberate effort. And so again, something we've done extensively is incorporating mindfulness. So first you have to be aware, keenly aware that these are the symptoms as a result of pre-performance anxiety that I am feeling, right? I'm going into a match, I'm going into a game, I'm going into a meeting. I'm experiencing butterflies. This is what I'm thinking. Man, this is like the eighth time I've had to go pee. I feel a little nauseous, but guess what? That's okay. My interpretation of this is I've prepared, I'm ready, I'm competent, I can do this. And so as a result, those symptoms and that experience of anxiety is going to be in your favor. It's not getting rid of it. Rafa didn't want to, you know, bury it or suffocate it. Instead, he invited it and it became his friend, so to speak, right? And obviously, he has performed at a very, very high level for a long time. And that experience still is a part of his, you know, training. It's a part of his pre-performance mindset and physiological and emotional space. And we have the power to do that. And so I guess my question with all that, Ashley, you know, in terms of just the reinterpretation of anxiety and especially some of the responses like butterflies or rumination, you know, how has this played a role in your experience, and how have you incorporated? What are maybe some specific examples?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember when you first shared this Nadal story with me, it kind of just like blew my mind. It just like all made sense. And it was also kind of cool to like have this like ditto moment of totally. Like, if he experiences that, like, it's okay for me to experience ditto. That because he's on this level. So it was really cool to hear that story and really cool how like he was so just like nonchalant about it. Like, yeah, this is the reality of it. This is how it is. This is how I know I'm ready. This is how I prepare. But yeah, for me, I would say I get the most nervous going out for a game when we're sitting and waiting in the tunnel. And when you were talking about, you know, anxiety is because of like what the future, like we're worrying or we're anticipating like a future performance, like that performance is like 5-10 minutes away from me, right? We sit in the tunnel, which for me like feels like years because it just feels like the time goes by so slow because I just want to get on the field because I know as soon as I get on the field and that whistle blows, like all of that anxiousness goes away because I can like actually just like run and work hard and just like play, which is like my favorite thing to do. So sitting in the tunnel is probably my least favorite part about game days, just because I just feel like it's too much time to just like think, and I feel those like nerves and those jitters, and just like, I've already gone to like pee 5 times before I came out, and I'm like, do I have to pee again? Like, I don't know. But something that like that we worked with and that you helped me with is just like breathing, and the sigh breath is something that like I do a lot in that circumstance when I'm sitting in the tunnel, just like waiting and just trying to like calm myself down and like calm my nerves and like calm my heart rate. And that's something that I do all the way, like sometimes even during the national anthem, just because it's just, it's just a time where I'm like, I really want this to be over with, 'cause I just want to start playing.
What is that? The sigh breath. Describe what that means to our listeners. Our thousands, millions of listeners. Yeah. Keep going. Sorry.
Yes. So it's one like big deep breath in, so like this, and then at the top of that breath, it's taking another extra little breath, like filling up your lungs a little bit extra. So breathing in, and then again, and then just letting go. And at first, I know when you introduced that to me, I was like, this is kind of weird. This is, I've never done this before. I don't even know how to breathe this way. But now it's like one of my favorite breaths to utilize, especially in moments where I feel like I need to calm myself down. I sometimes even use it, or I use it a lot before bed at night sometimes, when like my thoughts just keep going and I can't turn my brain off, and I know I need to go to bed, and I know I need to start winding down and relaxing. I'll do like 3 of those or something. My husband always like makes fun of me, but then when he's from the same way, I make him do it, and he's like, oh, that actually worked. But yeah, that's something that like I don't think will ever like go away, especially because like we care. And I think that reinterpretation of our nerves, or like having to go to the bathroom, or like when I have like an important phone call, or I'm talking to someone or having a hard conversation, like my armpits sweat all the time. And I recognize it, but I've also accepted it. And it's just kind of something that like I laugh about, but I'm just like, it's just because I care, or because like I'm super passionate about what I'm talking about. So like my body's just like super amped or excited, or just trying to keep up with, you know, like my thoughts and my passion. So I think recognizing what, you know, your body's experiencing, and then like interpreting it, reinterpreting it to be a tool to benefit you, to help you to perform better, is like super powerful. And it takes practice, but like once you start doing it, it's so powerful, and you can recognize like, oh my gosh, like this can be a benefit to me instead of detrimental, and something that like I'm trying so hard to like avoid or not make happen. It's like you said, like make it your friend and have it like help you with whatever it is that you're about to do.
Yeah. God, there's so many good points in there. I mean, again, if we're pulling nuggets and especially practical, applicable things from all of this, it's again, first and foremost, reinterpreting physiological, emotional, cognitive responses to anxiety. Then there's this normalization piece, a huge, very simple tactic that is going to provide that facilitative experience. Then there's deep breathing and putting in breath work into all of this experience. Again, for those that don't know the physiological sigh breath, it's fascinating for me, especially as a practitioner, because it's very evidence-based. I mean, a lot of this is coming from, and I know I'll say this name and there'll be so many people that recognize it, Andrew Huberman. He's a researcher, a scientist, an ophthalmologist, professor. He's all around dude. I have a huge man crush on the guy. He's probably like first or second on my list of man crushes. Anyways, he's out of Stanford, and his research is largely in and around this space of performance and anxiety and optimizing really just the human experience. And one of these ways that they have incorporated just tools is breathing. And one particular is the physiological sigh breath. And so it stems from essentially us as human beings, when we sigh, whether we recognize it or not, we tend to have 2 inhales. So it's like when we're sighing, it's like a sigh, right? And now we do it with deliberate action. So like you said, it's one huge inhale through the nose, and then one more at the very top, and then everything else else through the mouth with that exhalation. You do 2 to 3 of those, and his research, Dr. Huberman's research, has shown it decreases blood pressure. It produces higher quality of sleep. Your heart rate variability is increased. Blood pressure is decreased. There's so many benefits to it. And I know you can attest to this. When I do this, especially, you know, before I have to go speak as a teacher or going into something where I know like I'm going to feel some anxiety, I do this. And I can, not only cognitively is it affect me, but physically I can feel these things kind of working. There's like less butterflies, or the butterflies are just a little more in control of the situation. I have more control over it just because I'm incorporating a breath. There's a number of breathing activities that one can incorporate into pre-performance, but and I know, again, I know you can attest to this, the sigh breath is probably the simplest version of some of these, you know, some of these breathing protocols. And some of the most powerful experiences I think you'll experience as a result of just doing some deliberate breath work. You know, in working with people and in talking about this, to really solidify the message and bring it home, something that I know we've done is I have you draw a stick figure, right?
Yep.
And you think about whatever it is that gives the anxiety. So if it's soccer and you're shooting a PK, or if you're speaking in front of people at school or at a church organization, or if you're giving a presentation in business, draw a stick figure and have that represent you. Then think about your event. And then on your stick figure, draw the anxiety that you're experiencing. So if it was Rafa, you would be drawing some sort of drawing of nausea, having to go pee a lot, maybe beads of sweat, somehow drawing that he's antsy and he can't hold still, drawing like 100 mph in the brain. So your mind's going 100 miles per hour, right? And then it gives you this depiction of, okay, this is me with anxiety, right? Like this is the drug of anxiety and this is what it looks like on me. Then you share this reinterpretation experience. And so the idea then moving forward is to have this image in mind. And then the skill set is, oh, even though I'm experiencing these, I can still perform at a really high level. And even though I'm experiencing these responses, I can utilize them to help facilitate whatever it is that I'm trying to go do. Remember doing some of these stick figure exercises?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It's one of my favorite journal entries to go look back on, because it's not a bunch of words. It's a beautiful stick figure drawing of me. One thing, too, that I want to discuss with you or kind of talk about that has also helped me with this like in reinterpretation of our nerves is also the preparation that you do before the event and reminding yourself of that preparation. I feel like that's something that like really helps me, because I feel like we can have these nerves because whether it's a new experience or something that we're excited about, or we just really want to perform, we want to be successful. For me, recognizing and reminding myself of the preparation that I put in the week leading up to that can kind of like ease some of those nerves, or just kind of like help me reinterpret them of like, this is just because I care. Like I've put in the work and now it's time for me to go out there and succeed and go out there and show the world what I've been working on. So I think also just kind of recognizing, acknowledging that like preparing is also very important for when it comes to like managing those nerves. And if you haven't put in the work and you're not prepared, I feel like it can be a little bit more difficult, but also acknowledging it and recognizing it can help you in the moment be like, okay, there's nothing I can do about it now. I just need to go out there and give it what I have now. Or you could be like, I've prepared. I know exactly. I've done this before and practiced a million times. I know that I can go out there and do it. There's just 20,000 fans in the stadium or whatever it is. But I think preparation is also something that is important to address in this conversation.
Yeah, it can't be overstated enough. Like, again, anyone in any domain can relate to being unprepared and being prepared and then going into situations. and then recognizing whether it's in that present moment or in hindsight, like, oh, I was really prepared. That's why I was, you know, felt successful, or in fact, that's why I was successful. And then vice versa. Oh, I failed that test because I didn't study. You know, it's so simple, yeah. But the work has to be put in for really this reinterpretation and the deep breathing and the normalization to have the strongest effect. Because then you can rely on the fact that you've done everything you possibly can do to be prepared for that moment. So yeah, preparation is key. It's one of the reasons why, you know, there's so many examples of this, but Peyton Manning is one of my all-time favorites. I went to Tennessee. I'm a Broncos fan, so he's kind of the guy for me. And
your second.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There we go. He's probably number two on the list. Yeah. Peyton Manning. Wow, God, okay. I shouldn't put him number two. He's 1B for me.
Okay.
But he was the master at watching film. Like, that's what he was really, really known for. And sure, he had physical ability and talent, and he was a big human being, but he was so prepared. And so he would go into games knowing every different defense and cornerback and linebacker and what they're going to be doing on this play and that play and what it's going to look like and how it's going to feel. And so he was so good at altering the play calls at the line of scrimmage during those moments. And it's, again, a key indicator for me of, I guarantee you, he was experiencing anxiety on some level, right? But I wonder, and I would love to ask him this, maybe one day we will, maybe. Like, how was your preparation, like, such a key role in your performance and in overcoming things like anxiety, because you're a human being and I'm sure you experience levels of anxiety. So yeah, here's my question for you, Ashley, because you're playing at such a high level, the highest in this particular sport of soccer. You know, whether you're in your own lived experience or being around other teammates and coaches, how has preparation played this positive role in terms of overcoming some of this anxiety? And how has it been a detriment going into something knowing, oh, I could have done a little bit more? And so the anxiety starts to mount and take over, and it's detrimental to the performance. Does that make sense? Is that way too much of a question?
No, I think it's a good question.
Okay, yeah, shoot.
I'll do my best to answer both sides of that question. I'll start with preparation and how it's benefited me. I mean, kind of plugging this back into the conversation that we had in the first episode about confidence. But for me, like, practice is huge. It's super important, mm-hmm. just to prepare mentally, physically, emotionally for the game coming up. I know that, like, if I feel like I had a good week of training and I got a lot of good reps in, I feel good, I know that I'm going to be ready for the game, no matter at what, whether it's a mid-season game or whether it's a championship game. Like, I prepare for them all the same. And I feel like having that, like, repetition every single day, like, really, really helps me. I feel like when it can be a detriment, I guess it's also the reason why I have been able to, like, hone in my PKs, because I had a negative experience with PKs, right? Like, I'm a forward, I'm a striker, so I should be the one that should be able to step up and make a PK whenever our team needs it. But I had an experience where I stepped up and I wanted to take it because I knew that's what I should be doing as a forward, but I hadn't practiced it in a while. And I wasn't, like, super, super confident, but I knew I made, like, you know, I was just kind of like, okay, like, just hit it hard and low, whatever, you know? And I missed, and I was like, well, the keeper made a good save, but, like, I was just, like, I was super, super upset in myself just because I feel like I let the team down. I feel like I could have done more to prepare for that exact scenario. And so that, therefore, led me to, like, okay, like, I don't want this. I don't ever want to feel this way again. I'm going to make sure I just, like, hone in on my PKs. It's something that I know that I can, like, control a lot of the process. A lot in soccer, like, is very, like, you can't plan a lot of these things. You just have to make, like, do your best to prepare to be in the right spots, to like practice all different types of like scenarios, create as many good relationships on the field with your teammates as possible. But it's one thing I love about soccer is there's a lot of unpredictability, if that's a word. It's not, there's a lot of parts of it that aren't very predictable, right? And that's what makes it so fun to play. That's what makes it so much fun to watch. But a PK is something that it's, you can make it the same every time. You can make your routine the exact same every time. So that's, that negative experience led me to creating a routine that I can nail and I can do every single time I step up, no matter if it's home or away. But on top of that, I still practice my PKs 2 to 3 times a week, depending on how much time we have in training, but at least for sure once leading up to the game. But I also, it's something that I'm already kind of like anticipating and like visualizing, like, okay, if there's a PK, like I'm going to take it and this is how I want to do it. And I kind of, I try and take control of that moment before the moment's already happened. Ooh. And so like when I'm in the moment, I've already like been there in my mind. Yeah. And I'm not afraid of it because I've like already done my best to prepare for that moment. I think I've this PK routine, I think I had some of those thoughts and feelings like, oh, there might be a PK, maybe not. I kind of hope not. Let's just win the game so I don't have to, you know, kind of like dealing with like all those feelings and thoughts and emotions. But I hated that feeling. And so I was like, okay, I want to take control of this situation as much as possible. And so like there have been many games where I'm like, there's going to be a PK this game. And sure enough, like there was a PK. And with VAR now, there's been a lot more. Yeah. So that's also something that's kind of like calmed a lot of my nerves, because it's something that I don't have to like worry too much about, because I know if it comes, I'm already prepared and I've already put in the work to put myself in the best situation possible when it, you know, when the ref makes a call that wasn't supposed to be part of the game, but just the way the game went, that's what happened. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple examples to answer your question.
So cool. So again, here we are, listeners, like we have reinterpretation, we have deliberate breathing, and more specifically what we talked about, sigh breathing. We have normalization of the nerves and anxiety. We have preparation and putting in as much possible work that you can prior to the event so you can be that much more to execute at a successful level. And then you just mentioned another one, routines. So having a set routine for something that can be somewhat predictable, like you know exactly what you have to do to shoot a PK, to kick a PK, can again alleviate or facilitate, might be the better word, this experience of anxiety in the particular setting. So solidifying a routine. I remember doing this with you, yes, but with a number of other individuals. Solidifying a routine for something like kicking a field goal, kicking a penalty kick, shooting a free throw in basketball, having a cognitive component, an affective or emotional component, and a physical component to the routine is going to holistically set yourself up for the most success. So essentially, what routines do, and I know you can attest to this, it's bringing comfort to the uncomfortable. Because the pressure is on. I mean, think about things like shooting, kicking a field goal, kicking a penalty kick, being on the tee box in golf, hitting a baseball or a softball in the batter. Like, it's just you and all eyes are on you, right? And so, of course, mentally, affectively, and physiologically, how can I bring some sense of comfort to this situation? It's routines in a lot of the stuff that we've just been talking about for the last 20 minutes. So here's my question. You ready?
Yeah.
Your routine for penalty kicks. Walk us through specifically and explicitly what this looks like, and especially as it pertains to this concept of dealing with anxiety, because I'm sure you're a human being. I think you're a human being. You're not always a robot.
I definitely am. Okay, good. Yep.
What is this like? How do you deal with the anxiety of, I don't know, 20,000, 40,000 800,000 fans in a stadium watching you and only you kick a penalty kick. Walk us through that.
Yeah. I feel like my routine, like from when I first started trying to create it, like has evolved with kind of like trial and error of like what I like, what I don't like, what feels good, what doesn't feel good, what I can implement at a home game or an away game. And so right now the routine, which I've stuck with the past 2 years, is like once the ref calls for the PK and we know that's going to be a PK, I grab the ball. As I'm walking up to the PK spot, I bounce the ball 3 times. Okay. I just feel like it helps. It helps like kind of just like center me and like help me feel present. I just like nice solid 3 bounces. I don't know why. It just feels good.
2 hands, just like a basketball on the ground.
Yeah. Okay. 2 hands, just like bounce it 3 times. Yeah. And like 33, 3 is just like one of my favorite numbers. I'm a numbers person. Like my brain just like works that way. I don't know why. We can maybe dive into that another episode. But anyway, so yeah, just bounce the ball 3 times. Put it, like spin it, put it on a spot, make sure it like feels good the way it's like sitting, make sure it doesn't move. If it moves, I pick it up, bounce it again 3 times, set it down, because every pitch is different. Sometimes the PK spot, the circle is nice and pristine. Sometimes it's a little bit bumpy and messed up.
Interesting.
So I set it and I make sure it's in a spot that feels good and that it hasn't moved.
I didn't even think about
or
that.
Or like if it's a windy game.
Yeah.
Little details, but they for sure matter. And then I back up a couple steps and then to the left, whatever also just like feels good. And then wait for the referee to blow the whistle. Once the referee blows the whistle, I just take one big inhale, one big exhale, and then I just approach the ball and hit it where I want to hit it. And
is it different every time?
I practice that
routine.
Are
you watching the keeper, like where she's placed and where you think she's going to go? And so, oh, I'm going to go left this time and then right this time, or I'm going to go center this time. Like, how do you determine where to kick it? Because you have what? A second between you running and kicking the ball? Maybe half a second? Yeah. Walk us through that.
Yeah. That's something I will keep a little bit of a secret.
Ooh, okay.
But I do switch sides. That's something that I've practiced. It's just I want to be comfortable with hitting it both sides, especially if you're a frequent PK taker. You know, people aren't stupid. They can just look up and watch your PKs and like see what your routine is, kind of see like what your tendencies are. I know a lot of keepers will like watch your hips or look at your eyes and kind of try and read where you're going to go. But I have like my routine down. I know exactly what I want to do in that moment before that moment happens. And I'm practicing it like at practice the week leading up to the game.
Yeah.
And it's different every game. So like if I prepare for this upcoming game and a PK doesn't happen, I reset and I do it again the next game. And I have a different, my routine's the same, but I have a different approach to like where exactly I want to hit it.
Yeah. So the evolution of routine and the relationship with anxiety in this moment is evolving. I mean, you're experimenting with it, seeing what works, what doesn't work, and finding the best pieces, cognitive, affective, physiological pieces to deal with this anxiety-filled moment. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
God, so interesting. Yeah. So keep that in mind, everybody. Like it, especially you athletes that are trying to figure out a routine, whether it's soccer or basketball or whatever else, experiment with some of these things and find what works. Of course, practice it in training or in practice, right? And figure out what would be good and then go implement it and then go back to the lab, so to speak, and tweak what you need to tweak and find that evolution, find what works best. Oh, I just love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also another thing, sorry, that I also just thought about for like when we're talking about like pre-performance anxiety and like preparation, something that we've talked about and that you shared with me that has also really helped for me on game days, especially game days where maybe they're later in the day, or if we've had later games and then all of a sudden we have a noon game, that like my daily like pregame routine leading up to the game is also like super, super important, especially when it comes to like nutrition and sleep and hydration and whatever it is I need to get myself like mentally and physically prepared for a game. You advised me to just like write down a loose or detailed schedule of what the next day will look like. And for me, just like that simple act of like, okay, tomorrow I have a game. I'm going to wake up probably around 8 o'clock, 8:30. I'm going to eat pancakes with peanut butter and syrup and a banana. And then I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to stretch at this time. At noon, I'm going to eat. This is what I want to eat for lunch. Like sometimes like I don't even look at it on the game day, but the night before, just like writing it down, just like gives me like calms me down and just gives me a sense of control over my next day of like what's going to happen. And so I think that's also something that has been super beneficial to me, especially when I feel that like anxiety, maybe like sooner than I'm ready for it, or like, I'm like more nervous than I usually am, or it's mostly just a change in schedule that's kind of freaking me out or just giving me a little bit of like, oh, I haven't done this in a while. Like, what should my day look like? It just like puts me more in control of like my schedule and my rhythm and my routine. And I find it like super helpful.
Yeah. Again, it's a beautiful illustration of adding comfort to an uncomfortable situation, finding organization to a disorganized, you know, pressure filled type of situation. It's going to, in theory or literally, provide more security, provide more calmness, more concentration. And so I mean, that's what, 7 different tools that one can start incorporating to deal with some of these kind of pre-performance nerves or anxiety filled situations. And I think they're just proven. I think they're powerful. I think they're so effective. Here's kind of the last thing I want to mention. I would be remiss, and this might be the most boring part of the conversation. So listeners, you know, beware. This, you know, as a scientist, this particular model for me has proven to be very related to everything that we've just been talking about. And again, the simplicity of it and the powerfulness of it for me is so awesome. So this is, the author of this particular model is McGrath, and the last name is McGrath. I don't know their first name. It was like in 1970, and it's basically they're calling it this 4-stage process of stress, or 4 stress process ease, or however they phrase it. I don't even know if they have an actual name for it. Anyways, it's basically describing how we experience stress and or anxiety. Okay. And so first it's 1, environmental demands. What of the environment is demanding certain things of you? What do you have to do in the environment? Is it execute a free throw? Is it execute a penalty kick? Is it execute a awesome presentation in front of your colleagues? And then there's 2. And this one is crucial. Perception of demands. That is key, because once again, you can interpret in a facilitative way what the environment is demanding of you. And then as a result, we have responses to stress and anxiety. That's 3. And then 4 is the actual behaviors and the actions. So we have demands of the environment. How you're perceiving the demands is going to result in the response of the stress and anxiety that you experience. And then as a result, the behaviors and the actions will follow. And so, again, we can train the perception, we can train the interpretation and the normalization of all of this. It just requires some consistent, deliberate effort, like every frickin' skill that you want to get better at. So that's the take-home message, at least for me. Any other kind of final thoughts, Ash, before we maybe wrap this up?
Yeah, I think, thanks for sharing that. I think like you said, we talked a lot about so many different like tools you can use. And I think it's important to emphasize that like I didn't get all these tools in one game day. It's been a constant like trial and error and like a lot of reflection on like did this work for me? Did I like it? Like, yeah, I felt the effects of it. Or maybe I'm not sure if I did. I'm going to try it one more time. Like, it's a process and everyone's different. Like, we may talk to someone and be like, oh yeah, do the sigh breath, or some people call it the double breath, and people are like, no, like, I don't like breathing, or whatever it is, you know? So I think it's important to try these things and just reflect on how they can benefit you. Or if they don't, then maybe try something else. But yeah, like I said, everyone's different. And I think I would have benefited from these, just like knowing that there's these tools that we have, like as a younger athlete. I think I remember running cross country in high school and I was a nervous wreck. Like, I was just like going up to the starting line. I was just like, oh my gosh, I can't even live with myself. I'm so nervous. And I remember my sister being like, why are you so nervous? Like, I don't understand. And I'm just like, I don't know. And like, I was just kind of a wreck all the time. But I wish that like I would have known some of these things that I could have done, or I could have tried earlier when I was younger. But yeah, I think it's just, like I said, just everyone's different. Try things. Just this like self-discovery process, I feel like, is just like really important. So yeah. I think we covered a lot, and I'm sure we're going to talk a lot more about these things, like naturally through other different topics, because they're all like, they all intertwine so much. But, but yeah, I think it's just important to see what works best for you.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. Last kind of message for me, or last comment. It's interesting how when we shift from what people are thinking about us to just doing our best, how much anxiety starts to dissipate. That they call this the spotlight effect in psychology. We think everyone is looking at us, and we think everyone is judging us, and we think everyone is hating on us. But guess what? They're probably on TikTok. They're probably talking to someone else. And they don't really care what you do, right? In a lot of these moments. Yeah. Now, some of them, I get it. Yes, a lot of people do. But more often than not, we think a lot of this perception is happening, when in fact, it's not. And so incorporating just perception and reinterpretation and all of these things, and like you said, being very consistent and deliberate with it, is going to be just a game changer. So that's my bow. Yeah. Boom. Tied it.
Mic drop.
Done. Perfect.
Well, thanks for sharing. End of episode.
Ditto.
Ditto out.